Today's program is brought to you by Tabard Inn, new American cuisine in one of Washington, D.C.'s oldest hotels, located in DuPont Circle. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
Hi, this is Celia Cutcher, host of Animal Instinct, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
And welcome to Be a Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Carmen DeVito.
And I'm Alice Marcus Krieg.
And we are collectively Groundworks, Inc. We design and build gardens in New York City and the surrounding area. And our show aims to bring a bit of culture to horticulture.
It does bring
it
culture.
It does bring it. We did a lot of culturing. What a week.
Yes.
We did a lot of culturing. Let's talk about what we did in the past week, which is quite a lot. We have launched our new website, www.wedigplantspodcast.com. Mm-hmm. Lots of interesting things on there and lots of new things to come. So check it out. Give us your feedback. Tell us what you're interested in. We also installed our interactive Gardens of Discovery exhibit in Alice's front garden, which we encourage you to go visit for real.
In
IRL
Park Slope.
In Park Slope.
Or 550 11th Street.
Right. Don't ring Alice's bell, though.
I'm not telling you which apartment I live in.
No, don't. You know, you don't want fans pounding on her door, right? Just go there, check out the plants, and leave. But the cool thing that you can do is we have some great signage, and with your smartphone, you can scan these QR codes, they're called, and that brings you to our website, and you can learn more about the plants that are actually there. There's cotton, there's tobacco, there's rice, the fuchsia, the tradescantia, the begonia, all the things that we talked about on the last show, you can learn more about by going
there. And
you
can see them and touch them.
Yes.
Just don't pick them.
Don't pick the rice. We want to pick it. We want to pick the rice.
And if you see anybody letting their dog pee on the container, please tell them to stop.
And shame them on social media. No, I'm just kidding. We don't advocate that here. Okay, so we also dealt with all manner of garden and client work that week as well.
Yes.
From finalizing designs to trying to figure out why someone's hydrangea has smaller leaves than its neighbor. So we get a lot of tough questions like that.
And why is this a pale orange instead of a deep dark orange?
That's not the color I ordered. That's not the color I ordered. All right. Anyway.
Failed again.
So we get these weird questions from new and existing clients all the time. And at times, it can be really challenging because, frankly, there isn't a clear-cut or easy answer to some of these horticultural questions. And that frustrates the people who have to live with these gardens, their owners. And so this got me kind of thinking about why that is, right? So as I was preparing for the show, I realized that part of the answer to that question lay in something that today's guest, R. William Thomas, wrote in his book, The Art of Gardening, which is published by Timber Press and which we're going to discuss today. Here's what Thomas writes. A landscape design is something installed at one time and expected to remain essentially the same. A garden evolves over time, from season to season, year to year, decade to decade.
It is not a bathroom or a kitchen. It is not tile work that will be done in 3 days.
Right. So let this sink in, people who are listening. These words really resonated with me because Alice and I and our team struggle to impress this upon our clients. And it's a challenge as so few take this long view of gardens, you know? There's kind of like two, they kind of fall into two categories. Some expect the plants to remain essentially the same size and shape as when they were planted, kind of frozen in time as if they weren't living things. Mm-hmm. They have to stay exactly as they were.
As if change is a bad thing.
Right. No, why isn't it looking like that this year?
Yeah, what do you mean, you know, that changes?
It grew. I want it to stay like that. And then the other side of the coin is some clients expect an instant landscape where no soil or mulch is visible on day one, with plants packed cheek to jowl, requiring us to rip some of them out within a season or two to give them even a fighting chance of survival. Now, I'm not trying to imply that all clients are like this, but there's enough of them that lack the sort of required level of patience that garden making requires. And Alice and I hope that with this show, we can help some garden makers and some garden lovers appreciate and learn from the magical place that is Chanticleer and its talented and dedicated gardeners and horticulturists, because they take the long view, you know?
Yes.
And so I know I learned a lot. So to that end, we have the author of the book today, R. William Thomas, and Alice is going to tell us a little bit about him.
So R. William Thomas is the executive director of the Chanticleer Foundation, which is in Wayne, Pennsylvania. Bill has led the talented and creative Chanticleer staff for 13 years and recently co-authored with them The Art of Gardening, Design, Inspiration, and Innovative Planting Techniques from Chanticleer via Timber Press. The relatively young 48-acre pleasure garden outside of Philadelphia is now in its 23rd year. Prior to Chanticleer, Bill worked at nearby Longwood Gardens for 26 years in the Horticulture and Education Department. Bill holds a BS and an MS in Ornamental Horticulture from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Hi, Bill. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Now, you're calling in from Atlanta, right?
I am calling in from Atlanta, where it is today sunny and hot.
Ah, it's rainy and dark here.
In New York.
In New York. But tell
and
us.
I am thrilled that it's rainy in New York.
Yes.
It's also rainy in Pennsylvania, and we need it.
We did need it, right.
We desperately did. I know you just landed, Bill, so you haven't really gotten to see much of the conference.
Tell us what you're doing down there.
Well, today I went to the Atlanta Botanic Garden, which is beautiful, and they have a Chihuly sculpture, his glass sculpture exhibit going on. But that's beautiful, but the plants are stunning. And I also spent some time walking on the Atlanta Beltline Trail, which is a new arboretum that they're developing.
Yeah, I can't wait to see that. I've been hearing it's kind of the High Line of the South. Is that right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's high line, except it's on the ground.
Exactly. The low line. The south line.
Midline.
Yes.
So you're having zone envy there at the Garden Writers, Bill?
Yes, you can. You know, gardeners always have zone envy. But I love gardening in the Philadelphia area. It's a warmer area. I grew up in Wisconsin.
Oh, yeah.
Has a great climate, but you can grow a lot more things in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, you're kind of in the epicenter of American horticulture, as is our engineer, our sound engineer.
Dave.
Hello.
Hello.
Dave, you know, we decided to ask Dave some horticultural questions. No, we're not going to do that, Dave.
I went to Longwood Gardens as a kid.
Okay.
It's been a while.
See, we wanted to see if he's been to these places because, you know, we wanted to make sure that you understood, Dave, that where you grew up in the epicenter of American horticulture. Don't ever forget that.
I won't, no.
Okay.
And you thought it was about the Liberty Bell.
No, it's not about that at all.
Well, I mean, you know, everything you see about Philadelphia, they'd have you believe that there's just the Liberty Bell, Ben Franklin, and cheesesteaks.
And Rocky.
And Rocky.
Yeah, of course. Of course. How could I forget?
Right. No. It's much more than that. So let's talk about Chanticleer, which is a place that you need to visit next time you go down there, Dave, okay?
Okay.
Chanticleer has been called a gardener's garden. And as you say in the book, it is designed, maintained, and exists for gardeners. You're not a botanical garden. You're not a park. You don't rent it out for weddings or parties. And the founder of Chanticleer called it a pleasure garden. So, Bill, can you tell us about the garden's early history as a private estate and the landscape and the setting within which it rests? Because I think that's really important for people to know.
Certainly. We were the home and garden of the Rosengarten family from 1912 until 1990. The Rosengartens had a pharmaceutical firm in Philadelphia that merged with Merck in the 1920s. The garden is about 35 rolling acres, and we're about 30 minutes west of Philadelphia. We have a couple of big houses from the teens and from the 30s on the property. But I think of it as a contemporary garden in a historic setting.
That's a good way to describe it. So the Rosen Gardens, they were really avid gardeners. I mean, the name, Rosen Garden, yeah. I mean, like, it was almost destined for them to be like, you know.
Rosen Garden.
Yes, it means rose garden. And and we do have roses. We don't have one rose garden as we mix the roses in with other plants. But the Rosen Gardens did enjoy gardening. They didn't do it quite on the scale that we're doing it now. The garden has developed quite a bit since 1990. But they loved trees. They loved flowers. They really enjoyed their beautiful property.
And the property was, I mean, they chose it because of its setting and the big mature trees, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. It's, we have, they bought it when it had large trees. They planted trees, a lot of trees, and then we continue to take great care of the trees that we have, as well as planting at least 100 every year to make sure we always have big trees coming on. The property also has great topography. We're in the Piedmont section of Pennsylvania, and we have rolling hills, and in fact, we've got a great lawn that kids love to roll down, and even some adults.
Yeah.
And how's the soil?
Yeah.
How is the soil?
How's the soil? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The soil is a clay loam soil. It's naturally fertile, and if it hasn't been compacted by construction or changed by construction, it's an excellent gardening soil. And and so we're very fortunate. It holds moisture well, and it drains reasonably well.
Mm-hmm. The pictures in the book are sublime, and I encourage everyone to get the book and look at the Chanticleer website, even just to get a feel for how gorgeous it is. Rob Cardillo was the photographer for the book, and
he's amazing.
I was drooling looking at the book. It's that's such a cliche, but it is stunning. The photographs are stunning.
He's won a few Garden Writers Association awards, I think.
Right.
A couple of years ago, when Alice and I were at the GWA in Pittsburgh, I think he might have won. And if I'm not mistaken, is the book up for an award as well?
The book received, we're not receiving a Garden Writers Award, but we received one of the big awards from the American Horticultural Society,
right.
And we've been fortunate to get some really, really good reviews.
Yeah, it's very, Alice and I have seen a lot of gardening books, and this is
it's delicious.
Yeah, it's really good.
Yeah, it's just a feast for the eyes. It's beautiful.
So, you know, recently Alice and I went to Wave Hill, which in some ways is kind of
your northern sister.
Yeah, kind of your northern sister, originally an estate, then turned public. And I want you to talk a little bit, Bill, about how the area around Chanticleer began to change, and then the Rosen Garden family, you know, like their neighbors, they could have sold the land easily for condos and shopping malls, but they didn't. Can you tell us how they preserved it and how did they accomplish it? You know, like, what was the process of transferring it?
Right.
And why they did it?
Our founder is Adolph Rosengarten Jr., who is the son of the original owners of the property. And he, in the 1970s, was seeing some of his neighbors' properties get developed into housing developments. And he foresaw the future, that the land around us was going to become houses and, as you said, shopping areas. And so he set up in the mid-1970s the Chanticleer Foundation to take over the property after he died. And he passed away in 1990. He left a good endowment for it to help fund the garden.
That's good.
and he didn't restrict how we would develop the garden. He trusted the board that he set up and the staff that they would hire to take good care of the property.
Wow, that's important. And that's what I wanted to get at. He didn't just leave you this piece, you know, and then expect, because most people think, oh, well, it's great. It's preserved. It's fine. What about the maintenance? What about, you know, going forward? How is it?
Exactly.
You know, land can't be left to its own devices, you know?
Right. No. And he, as with any not-for-profit, he set up a charter that had a list of purposes for us, our mission. And the number one thing is that we're to be a beautiful garden that's open to the public. And we are open Wednesday to Sunday from April through October. And then the garden was also supposed to be educational. So it was supposed to be a garden that when you came and visited it, you could get inspired for things that you would do in your own garden.
That is the perfect segue for the next idea that we have that we wanted to talk to you about. You have bananas and borders, and you have rye and cotton as ornamentals. And tell us about that, because that is that's really fun. Carmen and I have done that on the tiniest little scale in front of my Brooklyn row house. But tell us your big scale kind of aesthetic ideology.
Because that's different. That's different.
Well, we're interested in visual splendor. We play with foliage especially. So we don't concentrate on flowers. We actually concentrate on the whole plant and how one plant fits together. And we're looking to have you get excited when you're going through the garden. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned rye and cotton, and we have an area called the Serpentine that we always grow something agricultural. So it's essentially a big annual garden. It's called the Serpentine because the beds are very curving. But agricultural crops are essentially annuals. And so this year we're actually growing popcorn.
That's great.
I'm hoping that I'm going to be eating a lot of popcorn this winter.
Yeah. That sounds fun. What variety is it?
And it's grown 12 feet tall, and the ears are small. It's a miniature popcorn, but the plants aren't miniature, but the ears and the kernels are.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah, that's one of the most dramatic things. Is like you don't expect to see a serpentine of cotton, or even rye. And I'm sure you know Bree Glovna, who is doing a lot of great work down south with edible landscapes.
Yeah, you know? And she's here at this meeting and in Atlanta, the Garden Writers meeting, and she's using her own garden, her own property, including her front yard, essentially as a garden of edible plants. And edible plants are so beautiful, and you also get to eat them.
Yeah.
Yeah, I noticed that you also, I read in the book that you planted rye or wheat, I forget, another agricultural crop, with tulips. Is that right, Bill?
With poppies.
With poppies, interesting.
Yes. And in Europe, very often poppies are a weed in wheat fields and rye fields. And we thought, why not plant our own weeds? And so we scattered poppy seeds in there, and it is a beautiful combination.
So how hard is it to get a job at Chanticleer? Because I want to come and work there. You gardeners have a lot of autonomy, right? And decision-making power.
Yes. There are six people we call gardeners or horticulturists, and each one is responsible for designing, planting, and maintaining his or her area. And it's a lot of responsibility, and it could be very stressful, except that it's not for them, because they're extremely bright, they're hardworking, they're well-trained, and they're excellent designers.
And that's unusual, Bill, right? I mean, to have the gardeners, to have this organizational structure that's really different from the typical botanical garden or other kind of institution, right? That's also very different.
It's not the standard, no.
Yeah.
And it works beautifully for us. I'm then responsible to make sure the whole garden fits together so that all of the different designs still look like they're part of one garden. They're all very different, but they still somehow fit together. And because they get to design, plant, and then maintain, they also know what their limits are. They know how much time they can put into something, so they don't complain about the designer, since
right.
they are the designers.
So is there much trash talk between the gardeners, right? like whose
There's
areas...
a lot of trash talk.
Yeah, I would love to like have lunch with that round table. That would be really fun.
The lunch table is a fun time, and they give each other a hard time, but they also are extremely supportive of each other. And you know, each one has great strengths and knowledge, but they don't all know about everything, and
right.
so they help each other.
Yeah. Well. Your book distills a lot of the ideas from Chanticleer in a really beautiful fashion. And a shout out must be made to the photographer, Rob Cardillo, for capturing so many of these moments.
Yeah, really.
It is just unbelievable. One of the most interesting aspects of the book that we loved was that each gardener has written a section describing how they built or maintained their designated areas. Dan Benersick's section on containers that he designs, and he creates were especially inspiring because we work with a lot of containers.
Yeah.
And his imaginative use of plants and pots, because the pots can be their own art piece of themselves, is really interesting. Can you tell us about how he approaches that at Chanticleer?
Sure. Dan Benersick is a whiz with containers, and he can do so many things with containers that I could never do. And so that's another wonderful aspect of our system, is that it doesn't rely on my strength. It relies on their strengths. Dan chooses containers. He uses them as accents, and he will... one container that I think of in my mind that was extremely successful was actually a grouping. He had about three very tall, probably 5 feet tall, black containers, and he planted a large yellow bromeliad on top of it, and then he had dichondra, the gray-leaf, silver-leaf plant, trailing down from it.
I think I saw that in the book.
It's gorgeous.
Yeah.
And then he grouped them so they were almost like individuals walking through a gallery or ghosts going through the gallery. In other pots, he takes one individual plant and plants it in that pot, and then we'll group those containers together. So there's an ensemble of individual plants in one per container, but they all work together as a group.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So they had to kind of communicate with each other in a way.
Yes.
And
right.
the containers are also, they're kind of like residential scaled, some of them, right?
So very much so. You could take one container and pretty much no matter what size your apartment, your balcony, your garden, your patio is, that would work. And if you have a bigger place, then you could have more. And then if you have soil, then you could have plants that tie together. Because he'll often then repeat what we have, or he'll have plants in the containers that either look like the ones that are in the soil or somehow repeat the color or the texture of those.
Yeah, he's pretty much a genius.
Yeah.
I mean, it's totally for people who are just, you know,
just starting homeowners, out and
it's
looking.
Totally. Yeah. And you, the use of tropicals, of course, it's been said for years. It's not a new concept, but I don't think people are getting it still how easy it is to grow the bromeliads, to grow some of these tropicals, the New Zealand flax, those kinds of things that that create so much drama, you know, in a container.
Mm-hmm. Well, and if the garden centers would promote it on a more retail level,
yeah.
So that we can get away from vinca and impatience and...
Well, the garden centers segregate, you know, they still have this like indoor-outdoor mentality. Like, yeah. This is an indoor plant and this is an outdoor plant.
Yeah.
And if they didn't, you know, if they kind of made it a little more interesting like Flora Grub does in California, then we would have more interesting plants. And I think a lot of people would have more success with containers, Bill, you know?
Right. And one of the wonderful things about these plants that aren't hardy is they take our hot summers. New York has a hot, humid summer. Philadelphia does.
Right.
Southeast all does. And so even if these plants don't survive outside in the winter, they just explode during the summer months.
Right.
The hotter and the more humid it is, the more happy they are.
Yeah. And you can bring them in for the winter, you know.
If you want to, and they can take the shade. I mean, we had, you know, in New York, and I'm sure in other urban situations, you have building shade. It's not dappled tree shade. It's not, you know, it's just constant shade. And we have found that using bromeliads, using guzmanias, using these tropical things that, you know,
Canna,
they can take it for a couple of months and really be bold. The gingers, you know, mm-hmm. all those kinds of things where none of the other annuals can make it, no matter how shade tolerant they are.
And no matter how much like Neptune harvest you dump on them.
They just will not bloom enough to satisfy the client.
Right.
Whereas a Guzmania bromeliad, Bill, you put it in June.
Yeah.
It looks fabulous until practically October.
Yeah.
You know? And people need to do that more, you know?
Right. And they really perform. And that's when we're gardening, we essentially want the plants that we're working with to perform for us. Mm-hmm. That's what we want. They got to look good.
Yeah. Yeah. We have to take a break. Stay on the line, Bill. We will come back in a second. You're listening to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network.
And this is Mad as Dogs by The Hollows. We'll be right back.
The following program has been brought to you by Tabard Inn. Tabard Inn, Washington, D.C.'s quintessential small hotel, is located on a quiet, tree-lined street just 5 blocks from the White House. Vibrant yet unassuming, the Tabard is comprised of 40 sleeping rooms, each unique in character and design. Feast on eclectic American cuisine in their acclaimed restaurant, or enjoy a cocktail and listen to live jazz in one of their cozy Victorian seating areas. Mingle with travelers from around the world who find the Tabard the only place to stay when taking their travels to Washington. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
We're back. You're listening to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. And we're talking about Chanticleer. And the Timber Press book. The first part of the book is really focused on design, but the bulk of the book, actually more than 3/4 of it, is devoted to the plants. So in that section, you say, we look at plants as functional objects. Plants, rather than structures, hold the garden together and render the visual excitement for which it is known. No plant goes into the garden unless it has a purpose. I love that.
Yeah, it's good. Good quote.
Can you give us some examples of some of these specific plants and the role that they play?
Sure. sure. And we do look at, you know, the plants are a major part of the design. They are, you know, and so there's as you said, there's no point in using the plant unless it's part of the design, unless it adds something. So one of the uses of plants for us is defining spaces. And so we have hedges in some places where it's almost a literal wall. We have other places where we have groupings of shrubs and small trees that have a more informal wall or you know, but block your view so you or aim your view in a certain direction. Going all the way up to large trees that enclose an area. So I think it's important in a large landscape like ours that you have areas that are open and sunny, and then you have areas that are more enclosed, and that you have views that are framed instead of just a wide open view. Mm-hmm. And then you think about what is at the end of that view, and of course you want it to be something attractive. We repeat colors. We have we may not use the same plant jumping across a path or jumping from one side of a lawn to the other. Sometimes we use the same plant, but other times we might use the same color or the same texture to repeat that effect. And that helps hold the whole garden together, again, looking like it's one garden instead of just a bunch of gardens mm-hmm. in a place.
Well, I have to say one of my favorite pages in the book, which I would call a horticultural centerfold, Bill. Okay, we've all heard the expression plant porn. Well, you guys have taken it to the next level. It is the photograph. It's a 2-page photograph of the varying triangular shapes of these different evergreens: juniper virginiana, metasequoia, and picea. I mean, the way that this is—it is so masterful against the backdrop of the deciduous trees. And I think that page like expresses mm-hmm. what you all do there incredibly well, you know?
Thank you. And that area, it's, you know, it's, if you're trying to screen something, you immediately think of just doing a wall, but if you've got space, if you've got the depth to do it, you can stagger the evergreens and you can put deciduous plants in between and have the colors play off each other. And mm-hmm. yeah. And deciduous trees usually in the autumn have great fall color, and so it's a changing landscape then for you.
Yeah, it's genius, because when people like you said people think of a screen, it has to be a monoculture of one species, one evergreen. This is so much more interesting and beautiful.
It was interesting when we were talking earlier, when we were talking about the design versus the plants, I was thinking about the chicken and the egg, right? And like, and you were, you know, you were talking about color jumping, like from, you know, mm-hmm. from one. So I was thinking, do you have kind of like, okay, it's January, we're going to start ordering plants and laying out the gardens. So is there kind of a theme each year to the plant selection? Like, do you have like, this is going to be a gray area, this is going to be a purple, blue, gray area, you know, almost like tastemakers, you know,
like how
like
do you,
in fashion you, or in
yeah.
food, or
how do you tie it together? Is there that kind of level of planning and coordination, Bill? I think Alice
right.
is asking.
So with the individual garden areas, there definitely can be themes, and they're usually when you come in, when you enter Chanticleer, one of the first gardens you see, garden areas you see is called the Teacup Garden, and there's a small fountain in the middle that's called the Teacup Fountain, and that area we design twice a year. We have a spring planting and then a summer planting. And so that actually has to be decided for the spring planting, because it includes bulbs that you plant in the autumn that bloom in the spring. The color combination needs to be thought of, you know, well in advance. But the gardener in charge then thinks about, you know, so say there's going to be a peach theme, a peach or an orange colored theme. You're going with tulips that might have that color. But then also planning to put in maybe a purple mustard in the spring that would contrast beautifully with the orange, and you know, so putting it all together with colors and with the textures, so the whole thing fits. And then it might go as far as painting the furniture the same color, or, or something that's going to complement that, that color. So it all fits. It's a lot like what someone might do in designing the living room of their home.
I get the sense. I do get that sense, Bill, that you let, that you consider it, like, even though it's many, many acres, it's thought of as a personal, you know, people are welcome
as an environment,
an environment, as a home, you know, as and people are guests rather than like visitors. Do you know what I mean? Like, it just has a different kind of feeling.
That's exactly, we want Chanticleer to feel like it's a private garden that you've been invited to visit, and that you're a special guest of the Rosen Gardens. And so we try not to have it feel institutional. We do like to call the people who come to visit our guests, as opposed to visitors. And we don't welcome you at a visitor center. We welcome you at our reception desk. We try very hard to make it feel like it's private.
Yeah, and I think you succeed. And I want to talk about, you mentioned the furniture, and we've talked a bit about the horticulturists and the gardeners, and I want to cover this because it's very important for the listeners to know that the horticulturists on staff perform a lot more than just the gardening tasks.
Right.
There's a role for art and craft at Chanticleer, and I'd love for you to talk about how the gardeners contribute to that with their individual and shared artistic skills beyond their horticultural skills.
Everyone who is a full-time employee has a winter project or winter projects. And so most of the gardeners in January and February will spend the lousy days, the really cold, wet days inside, and they'll work in our wood shop, our metal shop, and our stone shop, and they'll make our furniture, our gates, bridges, some of our fences, all our drinking fountains, parts that will go into the garden, and they're our gardeners are artists with plants, but most of them are artists with other material as well, as including wood and metal and stone.
I know, and that's part of what, as you flip through the book and you see, like, on page 197, there's an incredible, these incredible pair of blue Adirondack chairs that are imprinted with, as, I mean, they are right next to blue hydrangea. I mean, each piece, each section.
It's so thoughtful.
It's so thoughtful, Bill. It's so, it's not designed by some firm in an office tower in Manhattan that then is imprinted.
It's personal.
You know?
It's personal.
It's so, the stone furniture, you know, that's in one of the areas. Like, so many aspects, you know, are like, so you, the hand of the gardener is like, it's just so old school, Bill. It's like incredible, you know?
You really studied it, and that's the nicest compliment. Thank you.
It's old school,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So,
well, okay, so we're talking about old school. Let's talk about the ruin.
Right? Yes.
Let's just go to it. Tell us about the ruin. It's definitely, like, the most dramatic and romantic part of the garden, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
So tell us about that.
Sure. The ruin was built in the year 2000. It was on the site of the home of our founder, Adolph Rosengarten Jr. His brownstone house, which was not in disrepair, was taken down. And the ruin was built with a new stone, a wissick and schist, but to look on the foundations of the old house, to look like the old house had fallen into disrepair and now is part of the garden. And it was a brilliant move by Christopher Woods, the first director of Chanticleer, who designed it, to take a house that was, we didn't really need another house in the middle of the garden, and it didn't have a good use. And so he made it into the garden itself.
Yeah.
And it's a magical place to visit. And you mentioned indoor and outdoor relationships, and it's a great place to think about that, because you're inside the house, but you're also inside the garden, but you look through window openings and you see the outside, and you really do play it. It literally plays with inside-outside relationships.
Yeah. Oh, it's great. There's another, I'm going to start calling these horticultural centerfolds all the time, Bill, okay? There's another horticultural centerfold that features the ruin. It's the ruin's window, and it has a Picea Abies pendula that's framed beautifully. Like, there's snow on it. It's so...
And this is what happens when the land is left to its own devices. And the architecture crumbles.
Yeah. No, it's just so... so extraordinary.
So Carmen and I used to work at the Horticultural Society of New York together, and we actually heard Chris Woods talk about this...
A long time ago.
Many years ago. And it's been kind of etched in my brain ever since. And it's nice to see it in the book and see how gorgeous it has, what it's grown into.
I think the book was long overdue.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think, you know, everybody goes to Longwood, and Longwood is a wonderful place. But this is something personal. This is, like Alice said, akin to Wave Hill. We always...
Well, this is like the big brother, like the studied, you know...
Yeah. I mean, we always have a horticultural field trip with our staff in the summertime. This year we went to Wave Hill, and a number of them had never been there, even though they had been in New York a while.
Uh-huh.
And the way that they felt there, Bill, they felt free. Like at Botanical Gardens, you have to stay on the path. You can't do this. You can't do that.
And you just read the labels and you walk through it, and it's beautiful.
But Wave Hill, like Chanticleer, you know, there's places to sit. You feel like you're invited.
You can just hang out there and read for the day.
Yeah.
You know, and it's more human. Then research.
Yeah, and that's the sense that I get from Chanticleer, is that it's for people.
Right, and Wave Hill was very inspirational to us when we were first opening as a public garden, and it continues to inspire us. And I was just up there for their gardener's party last Thursday, and Wave Hill in the Bronx is looking spectacular.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it really is.
I hope they raise some good money. That we went to that gardener's party once, and there were boxwoods being auctioned off for like $10,000, $15,000, $20,000, right, or more.
Yeah. No, 70.
Like 70,000.
70 grand.
Yeah, it went. There was a crazy bidding war for like a 10-foot boxwood specimen.
Yeah.
It was exciting.
It goes to a good cause.
Fair play to you.
Exactly.
So tell us about the future of Chanticleer and what guests can expect in the upcoming years.
Okay. Well, this year we opened our elevated walk, which was a way of going down the big hill where the Chanticleer house is, going down to the Serpentine, which had not been accessible to people in wheelchairs, and it was really a difficult walkway to go on for anybody. And we have a gradual path now that curves in and out of the sun and goes into the shade, and it raises up about 8 feet in one spot and goes down just below grade. So that has just opened, and people are enjoying it. And for the next couple of years, we will continue every year to do different plantings, especially on the terraces by the houses. We will continue to evolve the landscape, and there are a couple garden areas that we're going to be working on some structures. We haven't announced what they're going to go, but we're known for being different each year, and I think you can be sure that we'll have different plantings and some surprises for you every time you come to see us.
What's happening this fall, Bill? Are there any special events or classes or anything? Because I know you guys do have the education component as well.
Right. So we do have some classes. We do most of our classes in conjunction with other organizations. So with the Radnor Conservancy, we're doing a three-class series. The first one starts this coming Saturday, and then they'll be continued on two other Saturdays in October. And that's on native plants and gardening essentially in an ecological way, environmentally friendly way. We have a garden design workshop that Annie Guilfoyle from England is leading, and it just sold out, but she'll be doing that the last weekend of October. And then we have a couple other classes that we're doing with the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society. And otherwise, it's, the garden is, we don't do special events. We want you to come and enjoy the garden for the garden's sake. And you mentioned reading in the garden and sitting and just enjoying a garden. And it, we do want it to be a pleasure. And we want you to leave with more of a smile than when you arrived.
Mm-hmm. And with a clear head.
Yeah, right. And I think Adolf would be proud.
Yeah.
Mr. Rosengarten. Well, Bill, thank you so much for taking all this time to talk with us today, especially while you're down there at the GWA. I hope you guys have a good rest of the time there. I think there's a couple more days left of the conference, right?
Right.
Enjoy. And next time we come down to PA, we're going to come and visit you.
Please do, Carmen and Alice. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. I might bring a date there.
Oh, Dave. Dave is going to bring a date there.
Dave's going to Chanticleer with a date. Excellent.
It's good date material, right?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for listening to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. The show has been written and produced by Carmen DeVito and Alice Krieg. Get the book. We're telling you to get the Chanticleer, The Art of Gardening by Timber Press. Please remember to join our Facebook fan page, Groundworks Inc. We Dig Plants, or... you know, Twitter us, tweet us at We Dig Plants, and of course our brand new website,
www.wedigplantspodcast.com.
Thanks for listening, and see you in the garden.
Happy gardening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.